Hello and welcome to Script Lock, an easygoing chat about writing and storytelling in video games. I'm your host, Nick Folkman.
I am the other host, Max Folkman. And today's guests are CJ Kirshner and Liz Albel. CJ started making Half-Life and Deus Ex mods and moved on to QA at Chaos Studios on Frontline's Fuel of War. After that, he wrote on the Homefront game. And after that, became a script writer at Ubisoft, working on Rainbow Six, Assassin's Creed, Your Shape, Far Cry 4, and currently he is independent and working on the next Homefront game from Crytek. And Liz is a script writer on Far Cry 4 and Valley of the Eddies, and currently is working on an unannounced project from Ubisoft.
Yes, that's correct.
Also, awesome. I think it's worth mentioning that Liz... she's saying pshaw, but Liz just recently received her master's in creative writing, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, oh. Master of Arts.
Master of
Emphasis
Arts.
Emphasis creative writing.
So she's now a master
Thank
writer.
Thank you, but mistress is fine.
Congratulations, Liz.
Thanks, that's my joke. Been flogging it to death.
Okay.
Is that what I'm calling you now? Is Mistress Liz?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Works.
That's how, for the rest of this episode, that's how I will refer to her. I think that's how we should all refer to her.
Yes, please.
Master Liz?
Mistress.
No, Mistress.
Mistress Liz.
Okay.
So we wanted to start out, you just went through your guys' resume, but could you explain a bit more of how you started out in the industry?
Well, my experience was I came to Ubisoft as a script intern, the first in writing intern that they'd had. So that was a really amazing experience because before that, I hadn't even considered writing for video games as a plausible career option. And then even if I had, I think just the idea of how you get into something like that would have been, you know, I don't know. It seems super hard. So when the intern opportunity came around, that was perfect. It was ideal. And then, of course, within 2 days of being here, I was working with Corey May at the time. I went to Corey and I was like, I love it. Hire me. Please hire me. So the rest of my time was just spent like saying hire me and just learning as much as I could from Corey.
Liz, I actually have a quick question for you. Where did you even find that posting for an internship? Because I wouldn't know where to look.
It was wild. They had sent their posting out to all the universities in Canada. And so I was just working at my desk one day and got an email from the chair of the English department. Just like, hey guys, we got this, you know, if you're interested, check it out. So when I opened it, I was like, no way, this is a thing. And then immediately put my stuff together and sent it in. And then called Alice Danino, who was the recruitment officer at the time, the next day, being like, hi, did you get my stuff? So yeah, it was serendipitous, I guess.
Do you remember what the requirements were, if there were any, for the internship?
Well, as far as my writing, they just wanted 2 writing samples, and at the time it didn't even have to be in script format. The only like stipulation was no poetry. So yeah, there was that. And then your CV, and then otherwise the rest was an interview later with Corey and Alice.
And as a slight follow up, do you remember when was the first time that you realized that people made games?
I was always aware of that. I didn't know, though, that writing for games was like a career choice. So growing up, I was playing Sonic the Hedgehog, Mario, games that have, if any writing, very little writing. So it just never dawned on me that there would be enough writing in games that you could get away with making a career out of it. So honestly...
Is that what you feel like? Like you're getting away with something?
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
But yeah,
I think we all do.
It wasn't until the call for script intern applications that I realized, oh no, I can. This is a thing. So yeah. It wasn't too long ago.
And CJ, how'd you go from making mods to writing video games?
So I actually started as a writer in New York. I was doing theater journalism. I was working for a number of literary magazines, getting humor articles published, and going to a lot of fun parties. But it wasn't paying the bills, and I needed a regular job. And through contacts that I had made during my days making mods, I had them forward my resume to the only AAA game studio in New York City at the time, which was Chaos, and they called me in for a quality assurance tester position, and I started there in, I guess, August of 2008, and proceeded to just make a nuisance of myself to anyone who would listen about, you know, I want to be a writer. I can write. Do you guys need some writing help? Let me put some words on paper for you, and we'll take the narrative to the next level. Just constantly slipping spec scripts under people's doors or keyboards or wherever I could really find place to put them. And eventually, through a series of, I guess, fortunate circumstances, we had a contract writer who decided not to renew. And I had the sort of upswell support of my colleagues who had been listening to this for, I guess, 2 years at that point. They gave me a shot, and that led to me doing a majority of the writing work on the first Homefront game. And then from there, came to Ubisoft, worked on a number of games here, one of which with Liz. Definitely the making of me, I would say. Not to flatter you too much, but it was a fantastic experience working on Far Cry 4 with Mistress Liz. Yeah. And I'm going to do it. I wasn't kidding about that.
God.
And just recently decided to sort of venture out into the unknown. And so far, it's been an interesting experience.
Before we go into like open world stuff and Far Cry stuff, working on Homefront, kind of notorious for being known for having John Milius work on it. Can you talk at all about what that involvement was like?
So John came in for a number of meet and greets and consultations early on in the project's development. I wasn't there. I was still in testing at that point, so I did not get a chance to work with him personally, which honestly, I wish I had gotten a bit more time to spend with him, because he is... One, an outsized, larger-than-life personality.
And yeah, for listeners who don't know, John Milius is a notorious screenwriter and director as the inspiration for John Goodman's character in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, he's Walter, what's his last name?
Sobchak?
Sobchak, yeah. Sort of like wears the yellow-tinted sunglasses and pulls guns on people at bowling alleys.
Yep.
But he also wrote things like Conan the Barbarian and Red Dawn.
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, he was the screenwriter on Apocalypse Now. He's got a very, very storied career in Hollywood in the late 70s and 80s. And I wish I'd gotten to work with him more, because that would have been really an incredible opportunity to learn from somebody who had been there and done it. But he actually... I don't remember exactly when, but he had a stroke a number of years ago, and he's been convalescing since.
I've heard he's recovered pretty well.
I've heard he's recovered enough to go skeet shooting, but unfortunately it sounds like his speech and writing faculties, this is what I'm picking up from the Milius documentary that came out not too long ago.
Yeah, we watched that too.
Yeah, so it seems like he hasn't recovered those, which, I mean, for a writer, that's got to be... a living hell.
Agony.
Yeah.
So I didn't work with him, a lot with him personally, and when it came out that he had not been doing all of the dialogue, I think if you really sit down and think about it, that's not surprising.
Yes.
I don't
know. A lot of Hollywood involvement, that's usually not the case.
Well, and it's not even that it wasn't the case, but you don't pay somebody like John Milius to sit down and write 40,000 barks.
Right.
I would still pay to hear him write bark dialogue.
I would pay to hear him write quite a few of them. And from a marketing perspective, I definitely understood that what he brought to the project was incredibly valuable. And I probably shouldn't be so okay with it, but it was my first big writing job in the video game industry, and I was just happy to have the opportunity. Now that I'm a bit older, I probably would have maybe planted my feet a bit more, but you know, at this point, it's water under the bridge.
How big was the writing staff on Homefront?
It varied. Again, there was a contract writer for a while. There was a lead designer who was doing some of the main story work. There was sort of a cabal of directors that were assembling the plot. But for the majority of production, it was mostly myself and our audio team, and then working very closely with level designers to find out what their needs were, you know, in any given segment of gameplay. If we've got a couple of seconds of downtime, let's fit some good dialogue or some story stuff in here. But it was, I don't want to say that it was just me, but for the majority, I was sort of on my own.
I know it probably changes at Ubisoft, but how many writers generally are on a project at Ubisoft on a game?
Actually, coming to Ubisoft was one of the more interesting experiences, because I had only been working sort of as a lone writer, or you know, occasionally with an offsite contractor for a while, and working with Liz was one of my first experiences working as a writing team.
Yeah, same here. I'd never written with anyone before. But like the teams in general, same thing. The size varies throughout production. You can start with like a core team of, you know, 50 to 100. But then by the end, it might balloon and you might need 600 to 800 people. It just really depends on the project, what other projects are going on, what resources are available, how soon you need to ship. Yeah, it's always in flux, really.
I think I can... Can we say how many people were on Far Cry? Because there were about 5 core writers here at the studio, but then we also had a number of people doing narrative out in Toronto. That would be Naveed Kuvari.
Yes.
And one of the things that is remarkable about working at a company with the scope of the games that are made here, and the sort of global reach of the studios is how all of that is coordinated. And there are dedicated people that maintain contact with every aspect of the project that's going on around the world in different time zones. And that's, we owe an enormous amount to them as well.
Yeah, and like Shanghai, a studio in Shanghai was involved when we were making Far Cry 4. In fact, they are responsible for most of Valley of the Yetis. So like the lead writer on that was, we were communicating from Shanghai. So yeah, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
All over the world.
It's a massive team effort.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of exciting because when everybody pulls in the same direction, it's unlike anything else.
So this is the first episode we've done where we had two writers at the same time. And since we have both like open world writing veterans, we wanted you to have you take us through the writing process for an open world game, which would probably be using Far Cry 4 as the example. So where do you start in that process?
That's a good question.
That is a good question.
I would say personally, I would start with the world, because it's where the player is going to spend the majority of their time, and it really needs to be a fully fleshed out character in its own right.
I totally agree. So then at that point, you kind of pick your inspirations, and then you have to do a ton of research with the idea that you're not simulating this place, but you're just trying to get a really great understanding of what it is, so then you can make your own world.
To give an example, like for Far Cry 4, a lot when we were doing a lot of the demos and previews, people focused exclusively on the idea that it was a recreation of Nepal, when the truth is there were influences from Tibet, Bhutan, northern India, There are actually some references in there from a bar in White Horse, Yukon.
Wait, explain that one, please.
This is a little, not inside baseball, but it delves down into a narrative subsystem that Liz and I both worked on that's pretty nerdy.
Excellent. So
there is a loot item in the game that is a frozen toe, and you only find it in the high altitude missions that are set up in the Himalayas. And there's a cocktail actually that's served at a bar called, I don't remember the name of the actual bar, but it's in White Horse, Yukon. And it's the sour toe cocktail, and it's a pickled preserved human toe that's served in a tumbler of Yukon Jack, and the toe has to touch your lips. It's just one of those weird sort of rites of passage, I guess, that people that are going through
and you have to give it back.
Right? You do have to give it back. There are people that have stolen and swallowed it. Anyway, a mutual friend of ours told us about this thing, and we put it in the game.
Yep.
And considering how many people probably lose toes to frostbite up there, it also fit the setting.
All right, not to sidetrack, but continue with your story of starting out working on an open world game.
So no, there's an enormous amount of research that goes into it. We were reading guidebooks. We were reading what else were we, like all sorts of stuff, adventure, literature, things like Into Thin Air and Touching the Void.
Yeah, to like academic work, you know, women's traditions in Nepal, love letters that were written during the 18th century. We just kind of went over lots of time and space and different cultural practices and history. We even did the mythology.
Yeah.
The folklore of the place.
We did a lot of research into that. And a lot of research also into things like the economy and the infrastructure. I mean, this was also a team effort. So the art team and the narrative team and the designers were all, this is really we can talk about it, but it was probably 25 to 50 people that were all contributing ideas to this massive pot that was being stirred all the time to sort of synthesize this fictional country of Kurat. But we were looking into things like how, like what are the primary exports of these countries in the region? What are their GDPs? How would their GDP be affected by, a conflict like the one that's portrayed in the game? What sort of road or rail infrastructure do they have? It's really about not just going, okay, we've got a, fictional kingdom. It's about creating that place from its creation story, from its origin myth, giving it a plausible sense of history, and then bringing it through to the present day and making it a functioning society before it's even, appears on the screen.
Right.
And I think one of the cool things about that, and Liz can probably offer her take on this as well, is that when you come to a part of the project where it's like, we need names for these locations, or we need characters to populate this region, or we need things for them to talk about, you don't have to invent it there on the spot. You've got all of this, again, fictional history. You don't have to make it up as you go. You can draw upon what everybody on the team has sort of brought to this and say, I know exactly who would live in this house and what they would be worried about and what their day-to-day life would be like, because we've done so much of this research and this world building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, that's it. You give yourself the foundation so that when it comes time to create, you have lots of building blocks to choose from.
And how long is the researching process usually take?
Depends on when you come on the project, but like CJ's made a point, I mean, it's not just us. It's not just one group of people. So you can always rest assured that, like, if you come on later, the team has been prepared, and they have a whole wealth of knowledge to draw from.
Right.
I mean, we were brought on fairly early, so...
We weren't pre-production, but we were there
actually,
when
we sort of were.
Yeah,
we came,
I guess so.
Yeah, we came on during pre-production.
Well, that's true. No, you're right.
They'd done... Yeah.
Yep.
So we did a lot of just book research, hardcore.
Months? It was, what do you say, 4 months?
I'd say probably about 3 or 4 before we actually started committing words to the page.
Right. But the flip side is, when it's time to go, you have to go.
Yeah. There's no writer's block.
That's right.
Deadlines, you meet them.
Right.
So,
but I mean, it also sorry, not to cut you off, but I'd also say that the research continues throughout the we were looking stuff up basically until they took it away from
it's
us.
True. No, that's absolutely true, because then you have to adapt as the story and the world changes. Mm-hmm. So
then when production starts, what is the first thing you start doing as a writer?
Well, some of the things we do is look back at what the game, you know, if it's a game in a series, what the predecessor game, like, you look back at how that went. So, like, for us, an aspect of the open world is the Bark. So then we look back at Far Cry 3. How many did we have? You know, how many voice actors? All the kind of stats, so then you can use that to hopefully do a better job with this game.
But yeah, we reverse engineered Far Cry 3 and Far Cry 2, just to find out how they worked. And we worked very with regards to the barks. And a bark is a piece of systemic dialogue that fires based on stimulus in the world, based on a non-player character, NPC's behavior. So anytime you hear them shout, "Reloading," in combat, "I'm reloading," that's based on a very complex behavior tree that an AI programmer or designer has gone through and set up. On Far Cry, we had two major categories of barks. We had the combat barks, which were all of the things that you would hear in combat, calling out the player's position, or, you know, "Holy shit, I'm being mauled to death by a tiger." And then we had what were called the idle fillers, which is any time that they're not in combat, because you can play the game largely in stealth. So this was things, and these were some of the first things that I remember writing. And I remember Liz wrote some really, really exceptionally good ones, right at the start about, we don't need rice, we need guns. I don't remember if you remember that line.
Right, yeah.
But just if you're hanging out around a civilian village, or if you're sneaking up behind some guards who don't know you're there, they'll talk about just their day-to-day lives. And again, that's all powered by a very complex state machine that is constantly analyzing the state of the world, the conditions, you know, whether it's raining, whether it's night, when the last time they said anything was.
Right. So hopefully it's like reactive to the world, but
yeah,
the idols are some of the funnest, because that's where you get to not only give like the true character of a person, but kind of the place as well.
Yeah. We got to humanize like 1,000 randomly generated characters, which was a pretty considerable undertaking, but I really enjoyed doing it. I look back on that very fondly.
It was. It's the private side, you know, what people say when they don't think anyone's listening.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask this question later, but since we're talking about barks right now, since we have two writers, we can get our writers' questions out right now for some of them, but how do you write a good bark? Because you get in a situation where you don't want to make it too long so that when repeats, you don't get tired of it. But you can't make it so short that it doesn't reveal any character through it.
And you can't make it too specific that you'll notice it coming from the mouth of 5 different characters. But you don't want it so generic that it could come from anybody.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Liz, how do you write a good bark? Mistress Liz, I'm sorry.
Actually, I think it came from kind of working together. CJ and I would bounce a lot of barks off each other, just kind of jokingly, but usually we end up coming out with something that we both liked. It's like, yeah, I think that'll work. But we also had what we called barks reviews throughout the entire process.
Those were invaluable.
Yeah, so we would get in a room with the AI designer, audio, and I think Loke.
Yeah, sometimes localization.
Yeah.
People were there because they need to be aware of what's going into the game, because they actually have a really difficult job of sending that out to partners to be translated into, what, like 7 or 8 different languages and texts. So really any changes that we make to any of the dialogue affects their dates and their deliverables
exactly.
in ways that oftentimes we don't consider when we're just trying to get stuff done.
Right.
So it's good. Yeah, it was good to have them there.
But yeah, and then what we'd do is we would play through the game and listen to all the barks fire. One, make sure they were firing properly, but two, listen for content. Like, is this getting annoying? Does it make sense? Am I learning something?
That line works, but it doesn't work with the response.
Right, yeah, exactly. So it was really fun. And then also kind of facepalm. I remember so many lines I'd written where I'm like, oh, I'm so embarrassed. Like, change it. We gotta change it.
One of the other things that we did that I think helped immeasurably when writing the barks was we determined that like each of these characters would have micro personalities.
Right.
And so we know that we've got this one voice actor who's going to be voicing this particular character. So let's just come up with a sort of broad list of character traits that we can assign to that person. Like when you, as Liz said, talking to themselves and thinking nobody's listening, these are the, you know, this is what their home life is like. Or when you steal their car, this is how they react. You know, some of them are paternal. So if you, in the civilians instances, if you walk up to them and steal their car, they're like, all right, but bring it home by 11 or don't forget to fill up the tank. And some of them are more perturbed, like, oh, this is the third car I've had stolen this week. Or, you know, are you really, you're really stealing my car right now? You're just going to leave me out here in the middle of the jungle? Thanks.
Right. So yeah, they're sarcastic or they're angry or...
And we have one of them. I don't remember who actually wrote it. It's been so long, but we have this entire bank of lines for the idle fillers about people's families. And so they'll talk about their wives or their kids or their brothers or their sisters and all of the dynamics that go on in a country in the midst of a civil war where literally it's family. You know, one half of your family could be fighting the other half of your family. But one of the responses, and I think it's from a soldier, is just like, you know, I'm an orphan, right?
That was yours.
Was it mine?
Yes, it was. So the way it worked, it was a two-way bark
call and response.
Yeah.
So they, one NPC would say one thing, and then another NPC would respond to it. Was that really
right? No, it totally was. So in this instance, we had one NPC saying anything about his or her home life. So anything to do with family, and then the second NPC would respond to that. But yeah, the way CJ made it, the second NPC didn't have a family. He was an orphan.
I've written orphans into a bunch of games now, then I realized that I didn't really, that's funny, because yeah. I had a perfectly normal upbringing. But I mean, you also, I think it's, you hit a point where, especially with Liz and myself, and during these bark reviews, we'd hear a line and forget who actually wrote it, because
it's true.
One, we were very, very closely in sync in terms of what we thought was working. And two, there are just so many lines that go into a game like this. I think we ended up with 15,000 plus, maybe even 20,000 plus barks across all of our characters.
Jeez.
And
facts.
Thank you,
all
Liz.
Of our characters and factions. And at that point, you are just throwing things into the system.
Right.
And it really doesn't matter who writes them as long as they're there for the recording sessions and the localization dates.
Yeah, it doesn't matter in the end. And that is another fun thing about working on such a big team. It's like, you do kind of lose your sense of ego and pride and self, but it just becomes a fun team thing that you do together.
And the thing about the barks, and it's, I suppose it's true of any major system in a video game like this, is if you do your job well, the player doesn't even realize that it's there.
Right.
Did you ever get like lost in the woods with the barks you're writing, where you listen to them so much that you just couldn't tell if they were good anymore?
Oh yeah,
all the time.
Well, but then always it's like, well, I find it funny, so yep.
Yeah, and that's
that is a dangerous road to go down.
But it's one of the things where it's nice to have either somebody that you're working very closely with, and again, the case of Liz and I, if I were doubting a line or if she were doubting a line, we could just toss it to each other and say, "Do you think this works?"
Right.
And we would offer either a yay, nay, or a constructive criticism. And then we had those bark reviews, which
right.
again, exposed us as writers to a sort of larger segment of the team, and they could offer feedback. And that's one of the things that I really like about working with that many people is there's a danger that it's not a danger. You as a writer need to know how to filter feedback and what should be actionable and what is if somebody says something is a problem, not determine whether or not that's true, but like try and find out what they're actually saying if it's not, if you feel like it's not necessarily applicable.
Right, and two, meeting with the other members of the team, sometimes the line's great, it's good writing, but it's not going to work for a technical reason. Like, I think a good example is with the combat barks. I'd written something about, like, oh, I've been stabbed. That's fine, right? But it was going to play for any injury. So to say stabbed wouldn't, you know, what if you got shot? Or what if you, like, got blown up with a grenade? So there are technical reasons sometimes why a line won't work that might not hit you.
And actually, the grenade thing, I remember there was one instance where somebody said, do you guys have any different ways of saying grenade? And the answer is, no, no. I mean, there's really only one term for hand grenade, and it's hand grenade.
Right.
Yeah.
But it turns out that what that person was actually looking for was not us to find a different way to say grenade. It was for the factions to feel different from one another and for there to be more native language in the game.
Right.
And again, that was a very complicated sort of, we had to break that issue down and talk with them and talk with the other departments about how, mm-hmm. and what actually was the issue, the criticism here.
Right. And it ended up being super valuable.
Yeah.
Because when chaos is going and everyone's running around, it's hard to tell who's who. So if you can separate that vocally,
mm-hmm.
it's better for the game.
And adding more, words and phrases that were appropriate to the region made mm-hmm. it feel more grounded in that part of the world.
Right.
But
and you mentioned...
But there's still only one word for hand grenade.
You mentioned briefly before about localization. How aware of you are localization when you're writing? Because it was something that we did not expect when we started out, and it happened to be very important.
It's enormously important.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as I'm going to get pedagogical for a second, but as games are like growing into the global phenomenon that they are, we don't want to alienate players in other parts of the world.
And it also makes you aware of language. Just how many, so for an example, a lot of languages gender their sentence structure, which is not a problem in English. But when it comes to other languages like German...
Or French.
Right. That is a thing, and they have to assign a gender to some things. It just makes you aware of different culture, different structures of language, different meanings that can be applied to the game that maybe you don't intend, but if you're aware of the translation of things, you can adjust that.
German is always... Yay. 20% longer, both written and spoken.
The favorite one.
And jokes that work, that you think work well in English, may not translate over well, or culturally may not even make sense.
Right.
We've got a really good localization department here that when they find something that, you know, doesn't either make sense or doesn't translate well, they will come to us with those questions, a big list of questions, and just... you know, ask if we could elaborate a bit more on why we chose the turn of phrase that we did or what a particular word means.
Uh-huh. Those were super fun, actually. I loved getting those questions because then it makes you think about your line and what did I really mean? And then sometimes on occasion, like it can lead to something better.
Yeah.
Which is also great.
Did that happen a lot, the localization guys coming up to you?
Not particularly. I mean, no more than normal.
And it happens more toward the end of production. And so there's usually kind of a time for that to happen. And yeah, there's not a lot of questions.
No, again, I don't remember there being sort of a flood of them. But I mean, they're localizing as we go. But really, once we hit the localization deadline, that's when we step away from the script, and that's when their work really begins.
Right.
Not unfortunately, but like to their credit, that's usually within the last few months of production. So they're like a freight train that goes from 0 to 100 in less than 60 seconds.
Right.
But we also worked very, very closely with the presentation and UI team mm-hmm. at the beginning of the project to define the character limits
right.
for all of the text boxes that would appear in the game. And it was actually, it was a constraint, but knowing what that constraint was meant that we could keep it in mind as we were writing. And personally, I love having those sort of constraints placed on me, because then it becomes a bit like a game of communication Tetris. Like, I have this idea that I want to put across, and I've only got 135 characters, including spaces, to do it. So you think very, very carefully about word choice.
Right. And leads to simplified language, straightforward, clean, better.
How fast can I get in a setup
faster,
and a punchline?
Yes.
Yeah, UI constraints are one of the biggest challenges that, as a writer, you have no idea that would ever be a huge problem for you. And surprisingly fun to work
with.
I
love them, yeah. Right. They're so much fun.
Well, you guys did a lot of that on...
Massive Chalice.
Yeah.
Massive Chalice.
I was going to call it Mighty Chalice.
But there were a lot of... It was a fun thing to find out from Brad, our boss, during the game, where we would be writing these random events that were all text-based, and then give an option, and he's like, yeah, this is going to be way too big in Russian, so we got to trim all this down.
Right.
And figure out your gender pronouns and everything.
So how did you find it? Did you find it made things better, or what was your experience?
I mean, it made things better, where it's always better for you to cut, like, not to be as precise and not simplified, but just concise as possible,
mm-hmm.
and just forces you to make the real important thing is what you get across right away. And
right.
One of the bigger problems we had was gendering, because our game was all was really systemic, and we had a lot of he and she variability.
Where it was randomized for the player.
Yeah.
Whether they could be he or she.
But using gender pronouns in other languages would be problematic with the UI, so we got around that by making it always refer to either the first name of your character, or like the first and last name, mm-hmm. so it would always just be referred to as that instead of he or she, which was a good break we caught.
Right.
Yeah, gender pronouns, especially things like Barks, where it's being assigned by a system, are always tricky to deal with. Yeah. In some instances, you absolutely want to have them, and in some, you try as hard as you can to avoid them or make them gender neutral. Exactly. Just to quickly sort of bring back to an earlier point in our discussion, when we talk about writing concisely and compacting down ideas into their smallest form, it's funny to me that when you applied, Liz, Mistress Liz, as for the internship, they said no poetry, because poetry is a medium that in certain forms absolutely requires that sort of precision and compactness.
Right.
Haiku is definitely sort of the hip thing to write nowadays, but I find it's incredibly useful as an exercise to distill those ideas or feelings or observations down into just the tightest package possible.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So yes, you should submit more poetry for your video game applications.
We're going to go back a bit even more and talk about, back at the beginning of production, how was the work split up for all the writers?
Well, when we initially started, there were only three of us. It was myself, Mistress Liz, and our lead writer, Lucien Solban. He worked very closely with our directors on the cinematics script, so the single-player campaign, nailing down all of the beats and characters that would appear in that. Whereas Liz and I were tasked almost immediately with the open world mm-hmm. and started doing that research, as we mentioned before, but also we started writing the Barks and the loot stuff almost immediately.
Yeah, we did. There were certain things you kind of started with right away, took a couple passes at the wiki.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what you do early on...
You started working on the love letters too, right?
Right. That's right. But a lot of what you do early on is sometimes, just for example, it's like knitting a swatch, you know. Sometimes you just do it to get it out, learn from it, and move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't really be afraid to throw throw some things away, especially if it's going to mean there's something better
right.
coming afterwards. We're experimenting all the time. I think that's probably true of every
writing in general.
Yeah, writing team or narrative based game in this industry.
Right.
Like everybody's just pursuing their own avenues of what they think storytelling could or should be, and yeah.
And then sometimes you're made to throw stuff away. So
yeah.
You can't be precious about that.
Yeah, you can't be precious about writing. Sometimes things just gotta go. But yeah, so we worked in tandem we worked together, but in parallel with the development of the cinematic side of things.
What were like the early problems you were encountering then?
Oh, we were perfect. It was fine. Nothing bad happened.
Mr. Sliz is flawless out of the gate. She's like Frank Sinatra, right? One take and you're done.
That's why I'm hired.
I actually don't recall any major issues at the outset. We had
it's just the volume of work.
There was a lot of work, and we had some fairly aggressive milestones to meet.
Well, and it did. It took us a while. Like we went through writing a couple character archetypes before we decided to assign personalities.
Mm-hmm.
Like it took us a while to kind of develop systems that would streamline the writing of these NPCs and barks. It wasn't a problem, but I guess through the production, we just developed better ways of going about the work. Do you say?
I'd say that's accurate. Yeah, there were a couple of characters that we both had that, you know, we probably edited and iterated their entire bark chain two or three times, and that's not an insubstantial amount of work. But it was really us developing sort of our own processes and pipelines to figure out how to do. You know, we spent a lot of time up front doing this so that when it came to do everyone else, you know, you spend the most amount of time on the first one so that the next 26 go very quickly.
Right. And then, like, afterward, when I got to do the barks on Valley of the Yetis, CJ and I had already discovered the system that we liked and seemed to work very well. So then you can carry it over with you to other projects.
So what happened after you guys did the barks and the letters? Were you writing anything else?
Oh God, we wrote pretty much up until the localization deadline. I mean, we were.
Was the lewd, the letters, the notes?
The notes, yeah. Place names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you and Naveed were writing the letters. It was fun because they actually had sort of a correspondence going. Were you playing? But you were playing the captain, right? Was it Robert?
Well, we did. So the love letters are from this Captain Robert to his wife, as he's making this journey into Shangri-La. So Naveed and I wrote to each other over email like we were these people. So that was fun. But to kind of switch it up, in the beginning, I was the dude. I was the captain, and he was the wife. And then halfway through, we switched. So then I became the wife, and then he became the captain.
And then myself and another of our writers, Lee Kuo, wrote... the player has a father that he's never met who's left journal entries about, you know, his family history throughout the world. And Lee and I took turns writing those journal entries. And it was fun because we could sort of bounce ideas off of one another and build on what the other had written previously.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some just surprisingly human stuff in there, you know, entries about, I think Lee wrote a really beautiful one when the player character, AJ or Ajay is born, and it's just, you know, my son was born today, he weighs this much, he's this long, and all he wants to do is cry and drink milk, and I just want to hold him forever and pretend like this war isn't going on. And I still tear up a little bit when I read that one in game.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not too saccharine to say.
So we've talked a fair amount of the overall arc of my open world game. Just want to know for CJ, has it been different for Homefront 2 so far?
That's a good question. And I can't talk too much about, I will say that it's not Homefront 2. It's not a direct sequel to the first game. It's Homefront the Revolution. So it's a brand new team.
Sorry.
No, it's quite all right. It's something that we're combating perception, really across the board. Just the idea that people expect the second game to be a direct sequel and pick up where the first one left off, and it's absolutely not the case. We've rebooted the entire universe. But I think a lot of the core principles remain the same about, you know, establishing a solid foundation for your world, you know, constructing a fleshed out backstory that answers questions before you even know what you're going to be asking of it, and providing the player lots of narrative threads to follow, giving them interesting, compelling, sometimes quirky characters. I think Far Cry definitely skews a lot more towards the colorful and insane than other open world games. But again, it's not just Homefront: The Revolution or Far Cry. I think you can look at a lot of open world games and see that common DNA and see the sort of thought processes of the developers of going, we need to build a functioning, plausible space, and we need to populate it with characters that the player either wants to kill or wants to hang around with.
Right. So they have some kind of response toward these characters.
Yeah, that's as true of Red Dead as it is of Far Cry, as it is of anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, totally. And of any writing. Like, whatever you're writing, you want somebody to have a response to it. Whatever that response is, good or bad.
Speaking of having a response to something, exposition is a pretty big thing in open world games. Could you talk to us about writing it? How do you go about it? How do you make it easy?
I like to either get it out of the way at the start or just be really naked about it.
What do you mean?
Naked exposition.
Naked exposition. In terms of character backstory, one of the fun things about working on an open world game is you have so many avenues with which to...
Seed backstory,
and, you know, deliver that exposition within the sort of forms and tropes of the open world genre. So, like, you can do it in diary entries that the player doesn't necessarily have to, or the character doesn't have to say to the player, you know, here's who I am, here's what I've done, here's what we're going to go do. You can find out those things, you know, through their character design on the actual art side of the modeling, and a lot of the performance will come through, and you can, as writers, we can see diary entries and have other NPCs talking about, you know, those characters. Oh, did you hear that so-and-so ate a baby when they were, you know?
That's not in the game.
Actually, I think it is.
Oh, no.
There is a bark in there about eating a baby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And like, we are having tropes now for exposition in games where it's audio recordings or... all the diary entries or stuff you can pick up as collectibles.
Oh, wall graffiti.
I mean, this is the thing. We do have some of the collectible diary entries, but like a lot of our notes, there's no system tracking whether or not you've picked them up or read them. They're just there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
About the audio diaries thing, though, it has become sort of almost a parody of itself. Not to really harp on Irrational, but they started out in System Shock 2 with... you know, little PDAs, personal data things. And it was a small size, and, you know, it was about the size of a what you would expect somebody to record a quick thought on, and it made sense that they might accidentally leave it somewhere. And then in Bioshock, it was a, like, 16-millimeter reel-to-reel tape player that you would find, and it's like, who is leaving these around the... And then it got even more ridiculous in Bioshock Infinite, where it became a full gramophone with a vinyl record inside. And I'm imagining if they had the opportunity to make another game, they would actually just leave NPCs in corners to deliver that stuff. That's the logical end of audio diaries, is just Greek chorus.
Like little candy grams that are just like running around, yeah, and you have to pick up and hold next to you.
Why are you standing in this dark corner of a bathroom that's, you know, covered in blood? Well, let me tell you.
I have to tell you about this guy who just died, about this thing he was telling me to say.
My mistress...
that conveniently coincides with what you're encountering in the story right now.
My mistress Liz has left me with a message for you, the player.
Actually...
I'm just waiting for an audio diary that does not matter at all to the story. Just like some guy sitting at his desk writing or something... And like
he's like, oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah,
some chicken soup for the video game character soul.
you know,
that's what it'd be like if it's gonna record.
You know what I'm thinking of? Mumu Chiffon.
Why are you thinking about Mumu?
I think he was the most successful delivery of that. One of the most successful that we had in game. Because he was Pagan's tailor. So he's connected to the main characters in the game. When you go see him, he's in hiding in the cabin, mm-hmm. cave. Right. And then so you get the whole his environment tells you a story. He's in hiding. By going into his shop right away, you know he's a designer. And then, like CJ was saying, so then you have the art. So he has a scar on his face, mm-hmm. I think, a lazy eye. So, you know, you can apply any kind of history you want to that, knowing that he's been involved with, like, this insane dictator, and now on the run from him. So, and I think, and it's best because it's not obvious and it's not forced. It's not a wrapper around, a mission, because mm-hmm. you go do hunting missions for him.
Yeah, initially he treats you like an ambulatory dress form with a gun, but he does have an arc that he warms to you and starts to care about your survival uh-huh. and your safety.
Uh-huh. And there's a line he says, when he looks you up and down and he's like, correct me, but it's something like, you're a little more Salvation Army than Golden Path, but I think I can work with this. But then, so also this gives you a feeling of who the Golden Path are, how, you know, clearly you can see how they dress, but it speaks to his style and aesthetic, and fashion is in Kurat, so this tells you more about the place you're in.
But, I mean, so much of that is actually not even writing. I mean, we were involved in those discussions, and we were definitely shepherding that character and that side quest arc. But narrative, writing... is our territory, like yeah. putting words into, you know, onto the page or into the database. But narrative as a mm-hmm. concept, as a player's experience of it, really belongs to everybody on the team.
And that's the thing, is story is not words on a paper.
Yeah.
Which, as writers, we know that a lot of writing isn't.
So yeah, I think a lot of our job is actually advocating and shepherding for the narrative experience and letting people know, hey, you guys have a voice in this, a stake in this as well. You know, the way that you construct your levels tells a story. And so not, hey, we absolutely, as writers, need to maintain control over that, but what are you bringing to it? Let's make it even better together.
Right. Work together, communicate, which is the hardest part of any project.
Mm-hmm.
What you just said is exactly why we don't just have writers on this podcast and why we don't call it like a podcast about mm-hmm. writing, because storytelling is specifically way bigger in video games than just being written by writers.
Right. Exactly.
Thank you for saying that better than I could.
Thank
have.
You.
Well, you can print that up on your t-shirts and just, you can even put your name after it. Just --, Nick and Max.
This is a good segue just to talk more about, we want to hear your thoughts about open world design in general and storytelling. And what are the problems Nick and I usually have with open world games, or just what hasn't been solved yet well in our minds, is how do you create a sense of narrative urgency and like a sense of momentum for the player to move on in the story?
Say like a family member has been kidnapped in the main story, and then you're let loose in the open world and you can just go hunting or go do a race. You have that option for you.
Exactly. Well, that's the hard part of open world games who lay a linear main path over the open world, in my opinion.
I think you can definitely, the key is collaboration. So you want, if you are going to lay a critical path over your open world, you want that story to have logical pauses in it where the player understands, okay, it's like, I don't have something that's super pressing or time sensitive. The stakes right now are low enough that I can go and explore a bit. Because it is a tension certainly that exists between that wanting to tell a directed, authored story versus wanting to grant the player as much agency as they can handle. And you run into problems in games where it's like the fate of the galaxy rests on your hands, and you're like, the hell with this. I'm going to go find out if there's if there's oil on Mars. So where, I think part of it is letting the player know through the critical path that it's okay to take a break now and explore the world. And part of it is setting your stakes so that they're not so high that the player feels
right,
like they're pressured into doing this stuff.
Well, and like, just for me, I'm just more interested in an open world game that doesn't have a critical path and just more of a playground. Lots of little stories that will cycle through whether you're involved or not. So if you don't want to be involved, that's fine, but it's going to go on without you.
So, Liz, you can answer this first, and then CJ, but what do you like most about telling stories in open world games, and what do you like least?
Ooh, good question. What do I like most? I like, this will sound weird, I like the opportunity it brings to write about the mundane. So if you're writing about an open world, you have a chance to touch on everything in life, from family to corporations to animals. You really have the breadth of the whole world at your fingertips. So you can take something super mundane like family dinner and then add so much tension and excitement and bizarre weirdness, which always happens at family dinners, you know, to that event. But I also like that it's an open world. So if someone doesn't care, they don't have, it's not forced on them. It's not forced down their throat. At the same time, that's also kind of a risk, because if you've invested in this and you're proud of it and you want to share it with people, there's a chance that they will never see it. But that's okay. That's okay by me. My number one thing is, like, do I like this? Am I satisfied? And if I am, then it kind of doesn't matter. That's the number, yeah. That's how I keep saying, anyway.
And what do you like least?
Well, just that, you know, I could invest a lot of time. And of course I want people to engage with what I've put out there. So, you know, maybe they don't care. And I guess since I do this for a job, part of my job is to hope they care and to make sure they care. It's one thing to say that for my own writing, but this is my job. And so I do have a responsibility there.
And CJ, same question.
It's tough because Mistress Liz has an excellent answer for that, which is, yeah, exploring mundanity and humanity is something that you really get more opportunity to do in open world games where the player is free to roam at their leisure, as opposed to a linear experience where they're sort of on the roller coaster, as it were. I think that outside of that, because again, I was going to take that one. Is fueling a player's sense of exploration and trying to figure out a good narrative payoff at the end of it. And then using really every system at your disposal to tell stories, major or minor. So, I mean, one of the things that I loved about working on Far Cry is that we got to name mountain peaks, and those names have, you know, some symbolic meaning, or just that every location that you stumble across was researched, and that the exploration part is really exciting. And then sort of using all the systems, I worked pretty extensively on the loot system, or on the content of the loot table in Far Cry 4, and it's seeded with all of these micro stories. You know, you'll find a couple of chess pieces that, you know, there's a king and a queen, and they tie into each other, but they're separate items, and they tie into another story that never really gets elaborated on or told, but it's there if you know, it's a hint of something if you want it. And so just really taking those things like
UI or objective text or trash loot and figuring out how, or barks and figuring out how we can really maximize, squeeze every ounce of narrative value
right
out of those.
And make it worth it for people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like normally trash loot, you're just like, whatever, I'm going to cash this in. I don't even want to read about it. But
I mean, that again, that's sort of the risk, is that you want people to engage with the content that you've made, but there is the danger that, especially with trash loot, they're just going to hoover it up and sell it at the next store without even reading it, or that, you know, by the time they've hoovered up the you know, 100th copy of vintage porn, they don't even think about why or where it came from, but there is actually a long history and supply chain behind that particular item that got it to where it is.
Right. Yeah.
Did you say what you like least, too?
What I like least about writing for open world games? I'm trying to think if I have anything that I like least about writing, aside from...
Or even just biggest challenge for you?
Just the volume of the content. It can be daunting. I mean, we get it done, and we get it done on time and within our character counts. But when you're starting out and looking at, you know, writing 7,000 lines times 13 characters, you just want to curl into a ball and cry, but eventually you realize you've got those deadlines due, and you crack the whip on yourself. You've got your team waiting for you. You've got expectations from above that this will be done, and so there's really no time or room for ego or writer's block or anything like that.
Yeah.
But when you get one of them done, you look at the amount of work that you've still got left to do, and it starts all over again. If you're lucky, though, you get a great co-writer, and you can distribute the terror and the workload.
Right. And then, like, exactly. It can get exhausting because of the amount we have to do, but then we each write a character, then I can look at your stuff,
mm-hmm.
and often that would lead to inspiration for me. Like, oh, I didn't think about saying this that way.
Yeah.
And then that'll, like, you know, spark another idea of how to say it in another way.
Turn the weakness into strength.
So for open world games, play times will take a really long time usually. How worried are you about recapping the story for players, especially if they take breaks between playthroughs? Or are you worried at all?
I understand how that's a concern. It's not something that generally enters my consciousness when I'm working on any of the content that we put into our open world games.
I'm kind of aware of it in a micro sense. We would also have the systemic dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So where you would go up to a non-player character, hear their story, and it could be like kind of a four-part mini-story. You know, they talk, press X, they talk again, press X, and then they finally finish. But the player could leave, right? And then come back. So kind of in my mind, I just sort of, if they had left for a while and then they did come back, they had to be contained within themselves, but then also make sense if that kind of... You know what I'm saying?
Like, I do, but I also think that the players that are going to come back, right, that really want to engage with those sort of micro-narratives,
right,
file that stuff into their sort of medium to long-term memory, so they're less likely to forget than sort of the casual player who maybe listened to the first line and never listened to any of the other ones. There's different player types, and they really all get space to breathe and play in open world games.
It's fun to try and do. And in a way, now that I'm thinking about it, it's kind of like writing an essay, you know? With each paragraph, you kind of want to return to your original statement. Like, I'm going to talk about this now, but this is why it's important to my main point.
Yeah, I think as long as everything makes logical sense,
mm-hmm.
you have to do much less recapping. People will understand how it feeds back into either the main story or the part of the world that they're in. Or though I also have seen games that have done the sort of TV episodic style, like previously on, I think Alan Wake did that. I think there was an Alone in the Dark game that used that device. That's one way of doing it. I mean, again, we're all sort of flailing about in this narrative suit. I think, you know what? Actually, I think the Telltale games,
do they do that?
do that as well, yes.
Do you guys know?
I think they do. That's, I think, the opening of the episodes. But a good one that I actually like was The Witcher 3 would, for the like the load screen into the world, they would have a recap of what happened, what you're doing in the story then, that would be changing as you moved along through different quests, which I thought was super helpful for us.
Oh my god, I've got to play that game. It's the hot game right now. It is.
It's pretty hot. It's pretty hot still.
Hansel's so hot right
but
now.
Moving forward in open world games, what are the big problems that you two see open world games still having that we haven't solved yet?
I don't know if I'd call it a problem, maybe just different ways of exploring story that we haven't seen yet.
What would you want to see?
I am super interested in just an open world that has no critical path, but does have story cycling. Like I said, you know, they're just going to play with or without you, but at the same time can react to your influence. I don't know how you would go about that, but I'm interested in
it. Liz, what you've just described sounds a bit like City Skyline.
It's
a city management simulation.
Oh.
Obviously reacts to your influence in that when you zone neighborhoods and things. I don't, maybe.
What, is that current or is this?
It's current.
Old or?
It's current.
Yeah, it's current.
Okay.
I think it's only on PC, but it may.
It is
migrating to other
platforms.
It depends. again, I think it appeals to a very particular player type. I like SimCity. I'm not good at it, but I find something really interesting in the idea of cities as systems and trying to manage and optimize and just. I say manage and optimize. I can't even get the damn things functioning, right? But it's one that you can, once you've got things sort of set up, you can step away and they do actually have little stories for each of the people. Like you can click on residents of individual houses and see what their relationships are. And I think that's all procedurally or randomly generated.
Super interesting. So what's that calling in?
City Skylines.
Okay.
I think moving forward, the content requirements for open world games are just going to continue to grow. And we're going to need to find a way to balance the procedurally generated with the sort of handcrafted bespoke content that we do. And Bree spoke a little bit about this in your first episode about liking the authored narrative, but wanting to figure out how we can sort of systemically assemble that stuff.
Do you think that's necessary for us to solve this because of how much costs are skyrocketing and how much content we have?
I don't necessarily. It's not a problem to solve. It's an avenue to be explored.
Sure.
And certainly, no, the workload is increasing and budgets are following. But, I mean, there are also so many other design avenues that we found formulas for open world games that work and produce consistent results and are enjoyable. It'll be interesting to see what happens when people start exploring outside of those, not just narratively, but from a design and system standpoint as well, or from a world creation. I mean, I can't even conceive of what might be coming down the pipe 5-10 years from now.
So then, CJ, what are you most interested in looking forward?
I am interested in, one, being able to continue doing this thing that we are fortunate enough to be able to do professionally, which is tell stories through games and write interesting content for them. I'm actually really excited about the possibilities presented by augmented reality, things like Microsoft's HoloLens, about bringing game content into the real world. I mean, it's something that has tons of pros and cons and needs to be researched and tinkered with and all those other things. But I mean, I don't even know, right? Like what video games you can play in the real world with that extra layer of display or graphics or information or data or whatever, whether or not you'll be able to do it without wearing a giant sort of Geordi LaForge. Actually, if they got it small enough to the Geordi LaForge
that would be super
style
cool
thing, because right now it's the more of the Kirk when he was
a Borg.
Yeah.
Or Picard,
but
rather.
No, Geordi would be very fashionable.
Yeah, Geordi's super fashionable. But, like, that technology seems really, really intriguing, and I want to poke it and prod it and learn more about it.
We're talking a lot about tech and, like, systemic choices in gameplay. Do you think that game writers should know about programming or game design or level design or anything related to that?
Oh my god, yes. Yes. Well, it's just like we were saying earlier, these system or these ways of creating the game tell story too. So it's for your benefit to know, it's for their benefit to make yourself a friend, like you're telling a story together. So the better you communicate and know how each other works, the better the game will be.
I think absolutely it behooves and benefits writers to know a bit of programming, a bit of level design. It definitely changes the way that you think about your storytelling. Mm-hmm. It does become far more collaborative. But also, and I think it was actually Corey May who said this in an interview a long time ago. He said that any change that I make to a script has ripple effects through all of the other departments. And so by being aware of what those departments do and how they do it and what they're bringing to the table, you gain a perspective on, is this change really worth,
right,
the disruption that it'll cause in art and code and design and localization? Or is it just me being sort of obsessive compulsive and wanting to redot my T's and cross my I's to just be different? So yeah, knowing what other disciplines do a little bit, at a level, allows you just to communicate with members of your team far more effectively.
Right.
Because you respect what they're bringing to it, and through that they respect what you bring to it. And yeah, then it does become sort of like an all cylinders firing collaboration. The other thing is that when you know the pipeline for how your thought gets onto the screen, gets into the game, it allows you to, and again, not in a control freak kind of way, but more in a quality control kind of way, track where any line of dialogue is at any point in the production process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. So you can look out for it. Make sure it's firing where you intended it to fire.
Yeah, and not too frequently. And just, right. Yeah, go and talk to the people that implement this stuff and learn what they do. Mm-hmm. And how they do it, and if they've got the time, and it's always tough when a game is in production for anybody to sit down and do, tutorials or mentoring. But like, if that opportunity exists, by all means, take it. Learn how the behavior trees and the state machines are set up.
And with that said, my experience has been the gaming community is amazing. So many people took time out of their busy days to help me. And this is still going on, but when I first got here, Aaron Contreras mentored me, Corey, you mentored me, CJ, and
sure.
CJ. And then there were people who worked at different studios that I met over Twitter that took their time to write to me and explain things, and it's just because people in gaming had done that for them, so they wanted to pass it on. So at the same time, it's a great place to...
Yeah, there's a good culture of paying it forward.
Yeah.
In games and very close knit community, not just mm-hmm. in Montreal, but now throughout the industry, and
mm-hmm.
lots of good resources to be shared, and people who, when they can talk about what problems they're encountering on their current project or what they'd encountered in the past, just so much knowledge to be shared. It's really unlike any other thing where people guard things very closely.
Yeah, we're getting mushy, but it's true.
Yeah.
And continuing our good run of nice segues, speaking of paying it forward, for any of the aspiring game writers who might be listening to this thing, what would you recommend that they should be looking at or reading just to learn more about game writing?
Or to get a better start on getting a job in game writing?
Well, this will be fun because I think CJ and I have kind of different approaches in mind. And that's sort of the point, is there's no one way to go about it. But for me, I would encourage one, play games. Two, build games. And there's a bunch of free software available on the internet to help you do that. And then if you're a writer, write your little heart out and then try and publish. I had been publishing short stories for a while before I got the job at Ubi, and it helped me get used to criticism, it helped me get used to rejection, it helped me hone my writing. I could go on and on, but if you kind of try and enter the professional market in that way with your writing, it's only going to benefit you. And then, of course, you can say, you know, I'm published here, I'm published there, people read my work. So, yeah, it's great to just write and play games, but then put your stuff and yourself out there. Not just on Tumblr or Twitter or whatever, but, like, in a professional avenue where you're being critiqued by professionals and mentored by professionals.
I will second that one. Actually, yeah. Learning how to give and receive criticism is crucial, is one of the most important skills that you can learn, especially in a very high-stakes, high-pressure, collaborative environment like game production. And a lot of that can come through publishing your own work and making games, and not just the tools. I mean, the tools are available and they can be learned. But there are also other things like game jams, where you also don't have to go it alone, right? You pick up a team on the site and everybody brings a different skill set. And that's where you learn how to collaborate. And you may also end up exploring skills of your own that are outside of writing. I actually end up doing mostly audio for game jams, or, you know, I've done some design and some light programming or art. It just really gives you exposure to that holistic, like, multidisciplinary environment. I think my biggest piece of advice to aspiring writers and people that were interested in writing for video games is just keep your eyes and ears open. Observe the world around you. Be present in the moment. Read everything that you can get your hands on, not just what you're comfortable with, but things that are outside of your interests or your comfort zone.
Yeah, and that's the fun part. Like, all the things you're not supposed to do, do them. Watch all the TV, play all the games, watch all the fashion shows, go on Twitter, go on Tumblr.
Watch fashion shows. I mean, like, that was one thing that I had never had to do before I worked on Far Cry, was watch, and I binge-watched a season of Project Runway, and I actually found out that I enjoyed it enormously.
But anything with our culture, any pop culture, mass culture, like, just saturate yourself.
It actually argue to, like, expose yourself to pop culture, but don't let that be the only thing that you take in.
Yeah.
Because there is a very real danger that when everybody has the same set of references or standards or whatever, then you just end up endlessly rehashing, and no disrespect to aliens, but you end up rehashing aliens. You know, the tropes that are present in that have become so widespread that it's almost a joke now. And we're actively all trying to get away from that now. So yeah, no, I mean, know what that stuff is, but, like, look outside of it as well. And often if you don't saturate yourself with pop culture, you can end up having some really interesting discussions about it. So I've never seen Avengers, but there was a discussion recently that came up where somebody was talking about, you know, have you seen Avengers? And the answer was, no, I haven't. Why do you like it? And they had to take a moment and think about what it was that appealed to them, rather than saying just, oh, you have seen it. Great. We can move on with the discussion.
Right.
Yeah. So sometimes not having those shared cultural references can be very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Architecture, art, right. Life. Like, when you're walking down the street, ask yourself why manhole covers are round. Wondering that simple question suddenly opens avenues of inquiry that you might not have ever considered, and it makes you a more knowledgeable, interesting, well-rounded human being to be curious, be playful.
Talk about manholes.
I have no segue for this. from manholes, but as writers yourself, because you didn't do cutscenes on Far Cry 4, what are your opinions on using cutscenes in games? Do you like seeing or writing for cutscenes, or do you think they have no place in video games?
Well, we each got a tiny little cutscene. CJ wrote Mumu Shufan, who has, like, what, 2-3 minute cutscene?
Oh, yeah.
He has an introductory cutscene that's probably about 2.5 minutes long. And Liz wrote Sharma Salsa, who also has a cutscene that's about 2.5 minutes long.
Right.
I won't speak for Mistress Liz, but cutscenes are just one more tool in your storytelling toolbox for you to draw upon. They're the things that definitely have the most production considerations attached to them in terms of, like, recording time, motion capture, animation, you know, set dressing, art, all of that stuff. They can quickly increase the time and cost of any project. So I think the trick is probably to use them, not sparingly, but again, just keep them as one piece of storytelling kit in your wider arsenal.
I agree. And I enjoyed a shorter cutscene with, you know, like the 2-3 minutes. Often I'm just like, skip, skip, skip. Why can't I skip this? Skip, skip, skip. But, two, they can be a reward. Like, if you've just, you know, finished an exhausting boss battle, that end cutscene is kind of like the reward for you and the rest. And I agree with CJ. There's a time and place for them.
That is the good answer. But we're going to wind this down to our last question. What are you playing right now?
Well, like I said, playing Game of War, I'm in an alliance. Best alliance. Best alliance of the best.
Is Kate Upton in your guild?
Oh, she's not. But she tries to,
oh, yeah, it's
she
that
tries
game.
To sell me stuff every time I log in.
Does it work?
Oh, I don't want to answer that.
Fair enough.
No comment. That, and then my husband and I are also playing Monster Strike, which is also a phone game, and we're just addicted. But that one's fun because we can play together. And, it's silly, but it's fun. It's just like pinball for your monsters. And then, of course, you upgrade your monsters. But yeah, it's fun. I don't know.
I just got Grand Theft Auto 5 on PC, so I'm diving back in. I like to role play as a highway patrolman. So I've... I will chase down other players and ask for their license and registration. And the player reactions so far have run the gamut from I'm just going to shoot you and continue moving on, like, on with the game that I was playing, to what is going on, to okay, I'll play along. Role playing as a cop in GTA is a complicated and experience.
Dangerous, no doubt.
Very dangerous.
Yeah.
There's also all sorts of other things to be said about it. I'm trying to just even get my own thoughts down before I say too much more about it. But yeah, he's got a goofy 70s Tom Selleck mustache and aviators and a giant white helmet.
Have you arrested people?
Not only have I arrested people, you can't actually arrest people, but I have issued fake citations. And at one point, oh God, I'm going to tell this story. At one point, there was a gang fight on the sort of recreation equivalent of Venice Beach. And so I drove down there because I could see that there were just dots, you know, going every which way and being killed. And I tried to break this gunfight up. And it was one of the instances where the players all reacted as in, we'll play along. And then somebody showed up in a military jet, and got out, and they were wearing fatigues and like a general's uniform, and they were arguing that they had jurisdiction over the beach. Yeah. And so we got into this big argument about whose territory this was actually to patrol. And then another player started playing as my desk sergeant and called me back and busted me to bike cop. So I had to turn in the patrol car that I had stolen. Because you can't get them legitimately, unfortunately.
and I bought one of the bicycles that you can get from the in-game store, and I was riding up and down the boardwalk harassing the NPCs going, you know, there's a drunk in the corner. I'm like, sir, you're going to have to move along, sir. I smell weed. Ma'am, anyway, I'm playing Portal with my girlfriend. She's getting into it. I'm trying to sort of, I've been trying to ease her into, games literacy for some time. I thought Journey would be a good entry point, and it turns out that handing somebody who's never played a console game or what we consider a modern video game before, handing them a controller, the twin sticks is, somebody put it really well. They said you wouldn't hand somebody a flute, which has got just as many buttons as an Xbox controller, and say, figure it out. But she seems to be taking to the mouse and keyboard setup, and she likes the puzzles, and it's a relatively non-threatening game, so a good place to start.
And it
has a good, concise story to it. And then I think the highlight of the things that I played recently was I got the opportunity to play Tetris in Red Square in Moscow. And so I was standing there with my back to the Kremlin, and I think it's St. Basil's, the huge basilica with the onion domes in front of me, just listening to those like tiny little chiptune Russian folk songs. And it was awesome. That was so cool.
But on that note, thank you very much for hanging out with us and talking to us about storytelling.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah, it's been delightful.
Where can people find you on the internet?
In the dark corners of the internet.
Is that where you lurk now?
Yes.
Where can people find Mistress Liz on the internet?
Oh, Twitter. Just Ms. Liz Albel. I have my website, Liz Albel. These are good options.
And I'm on Twitter as well as just CJ Kirshner.
Oh, and I'm Nick. I'm Twin Made Films on Twitter. And I am Max, and I am Max Folk Max on Twitter. And you can find this podcast at Script Lock Cast.